Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents A Mom, a Wand, and a Mission, an Oriseran Urban Cozy by Martha Carr and Michael Anderle, narrated by Tracy Odom. Chapter 1. The Silver Griffin's office was dark, quiet, and still. The only movement, a swirling of dust motes around the outlet from the air conditioning system. Lucy Heron walked between the desks, watching for any sign of activity, any shifting of shadows that could have shown her that someone was around. This was uncanny. The office was never this deserted. There were always witches and wizards around, logging cases, sifting evidence, preparing to rush out and hunt down rogue magicals. Gnomes were always pottering back and forth with armfuls of papers as they filed, archived, and did all the mundane yet precise administrative tasks that kept the office going. There were always pigeons, scattering feathers as they hurtled through the upper reaches of the office with mission briefings for field agents strapped to their legs. The office couldn't possibly be this quiet. It defied all logic. She ran a finger across a desk. It came away dusty. Lucy knew dust. She was a mom with a good-sized house and three kids to chase after, none of whom were as handy with a duster as she would have liked. She knew what it looked like when the top of a cupboard or an out-of-the-way ornament went untended for too long. This wasn't that sort of dust. This was something darker, with a greasy texture. When she wiped the finger on her leg, it left a coal black stain down her wedding dress. Wait, why was she wearing her wedding dress? That made no sense at all. The dress was carefully packed away in the attic of the family home, as it had been for the past decade. She and Charlie had gotten it out once to indulge in a moment of pure nostalgia not long after Ashley was born, but had kept it safely boxed up ever since. No way she would be wearing it in the office. Why was she here in the office on a Saturday night? She felt like there was something she had to do, but she wasn't sure what. Her wand hand tingled. Although the wand wasn't there, sparks of magic gleamed in her palm, stinging her. Their sharpness cut through the fog in her mind. And suddenly it all became clear. This was a dream. She sighed in relief, sat at her desk and spun in her chair, letting the dress spin out with her. If she was asleep, she might as well relax. Except that something was moving in the shadows, and she didn't think it had come to give her a good night kiss. She got to her feet and peered into the darkness. Now that she looked more closely, she realized that it wasn't a movement within the shadows. The shadows themselves were in motion, swirling, churning, and oozing across the floor like a dark tide. She looked across her desk, but there was no sign of her wand or anything else she could use to defend herself. She yanked open the top drawer, but the only things inside were toys belonging to Eddie, her youngest kid. Most of them were plastic robots or dinosaurs. She slammed the drawer shut and stood protectively over it, glaring at the shifting shadows.
You can't have this!
She laid her hand on the drawer.
I don't want that.
The shadows spun into a dark gray pillar of smoke, tinged with metallic blue and putrescent yellow. Its voice was a croak as if it was choking on itself.
I've come for you, Lucy Heron. I'm going to have my revenge.
Lucy coughed. The air stank of car fumes and burning plastic, with a hint of something even worse. Tendrils of smoke reached for her. She raised her hand to counter it, but she didn't have her wand, and she couldn't punch the smoke.
You're gone, she said to Blight. We destroyed you.
You could never destroy me. Not while the filth of your cities remains.
Streams of smog reached for Lucy. She stepped back, tripped over her chair, and fell on her back. The pollution kept advancing. She twisted over, the dress ripping as she trod on a section of the hem, then scrambled to her feet and ran.
She dashed down a corridor, away from the main office floor and into the depths of the Silver Griffin's L.A. offices. She couldn't escape the stink of pollution or the taste of toxins in her mouth with every breath. She couldn't get away from the rasping, wheezing noise of Blight. Still, she ran because it was all that she could do, and because the corridor seemed to stretch on forever, mile after mile of featureless concrete. Her friends Jackie and Sarah appeared on either side of her, dressed in their running gear. "Mustn't be late," Sarah said. "Ellis is waiting." "And, of course," Jackie said, "the future of the world is at stake." Then they both dashed off down side corridors that closed behind them, leaving Lucy all alone. At the end of the corridor, she stumbled into the pigeon loft. The birds all stopped their cooing and pecking to look at her. Lucy leaned over and propped her hands on her knees, trying to catch her breath. She left the smoky odor behind, but something else didn't smell right here. It was a different sort of stink, lower and more earthy, but equally unpleasant. Tar ran down the walls and oozed across the floor. It dripped from the ceiling, coating the pigeons' feathers and sticking their wings to their sides. They made sounds of distress, and some tried to take flight but fell to the floor with sickening splats. An orange figure lumbered from between the cages at the back of the room. His flesh rippled above his shorts. Large, frog-like eyes stared at Lucy.
"Cyril," Lucy whispered, "I saw you die."
"The devil offers the best deals," Zero replied. "I'll give you a way out of this in return for your soul."
"I'm not selling my soul to you."
"Fine, your children's souls, then. They won't need them."
"I'm not selling you my children."
"I can offer a fair price."
Zero opened his hand and gemstones tumbled out.
"Well, fair for me, at least."
"How many times do I have to say no?"
"All right, then. If you won't give me anything, I'll take it from you."
Zero waved, and a swarm of tiny black creatures appeared in the air around him.
"Go get her, my pretties."
As the swarm of magical mites hurtled toward Lucy, she turned and raced away back down the corridor. Except that it was a different corridor, a lower level of the Griffin's HQ than she'd been on before. The swarm buzzed after her, ready to descend and devour her if she paused for even a second. The world filled with their buzzing, the hammering of her feet against the floor and her pounding heartbeat.
"Wake up! Wake up! Wake up!" she gasped to herself. "I have to wake up!"
Although she pressed her nails into the palms of her hands, she could barely cling to the knowledge that she was asleep, never mind escape into wakefulness. The corridor ended, and she emerged in the transport room. Someone had set out a row of desks in the middle of the floor where they brought prisoners from magical travel to Trevelsome Prison. Many magicals sat at them, including witches, wizards, gnomes, dwarves, and elves. A Willen at the front wore a particularly sour look on her face, and the human sitting next to her in the sleeveless hoodie looked like he wanted to punch the whole world. At the front of the class stood Meredith Womack, witch and con woman, waving a slim black wand bound in dull iron.
"Today's lesson, class, is dealing with the authorities," Womack said. "It's going to be a practical lesson."
She waved her wand. A bolt of ice flew toward Lucy, who dove to the floor. The ice magic froze the wall behind her. She rolled over and sprang to her feet, the dress now thoroughly torn and dirty. The whole class was staring at her. Each of them had magic shining around their fingers or the tip of a wand.
"Come on, come on."
Lucy tried to will her wand into her hand. After all, this was a dream, and hers had some special power when it came to those. That should count for something, right? Regardless of how hard she strained, it still wasn't there.
"On my mark,"
Womack pointed her wand.
3, 2, 1.
Lucy dashed off down the corridor again.
"Go!"
Magic flew all around Lucy, fireballs and glue spells and freezes spattering the walls. A chorus of footsteps told her that the class was hot on her tail. She didn't dare look back. She kept running until a steel bulkhead slid aside ahead of her, and she stepped into the familiar surroundings of the special equipment and weapons lab.
"Jenkins!" she shouted. "Jenkins, are you here?"
In the shadows at the far end of the test range, she glimpsed a lab coat.
"Thank goodness," Lucy said. "I need a weapon, any weapon, something to defend myself with. Or a wand. Yeah, the new ones don't hurt, right?"
Someone walked out of the shadows. But instead of having Jenkins' ginger hair, they were bald, their heads smooth and pale. The lab coat fell to the floor, revealing a black suit on a slender, sinister frame.
"Mr. No!"
Lucy glared at him.
"I should have known. Who else could be giving me nightmares like this?"
Mr. No laughed, and the sound was like a knife blade rasping over a whetstone.
"Oh, this isn't me, Agent Heron. How could it possibly be me? You defeated me, remember? Just like you defeated them."
The crime school burst through the door behind her.
"And them."
Zero and his swarm stepped out of a shadow.
"And him."
The cloud called Blight swirled down from the ceiling.
"And so many more."
Other old opponents appeared, from a glowing businessman in a white suit to a graffiti artist with spray cans floating around her head.
"So many of us all gone. Still, you can't defeat what's on its way. The end time is coming, Lucy Heron. It's coming for you."
Mr. No took another step forward, and a shadow fell across him. The same happened to the artist, the businessman, the crime school, and the loan shark. Even the smog seemed to be drenched in shadow, becoming deeper darkness that set a wave of terror racing through Lucy. They closed in on her, all these enemies coming at once, but none of them themselves. They merged as the darkness closed in, about to engulf her. She desperately wished for anything to fight them with, some slim thread of magic. Then she felt cool wood in her hand. She raised her wand and cast a spell.
"Lumen!"
There was a flash of light, and Lucy woke up in her bed. She sat bolt upright. The wand was in her hand, and the fading afterglow of the light flash filled the room. Beside her, Charlie rolled over and rubbed his eyes.
"Are you okay?"
he asked.
"I think something terrible is coming."
Lucy clutched her wand tight.
"But I have no idea what."
Chapter 2. Deep under L.A., so far that even the cockroaches found no comfort, the shadow man stirred. By the light of old and dripping candles made from rancid fat, they peeled themselves off the walls of caves that had been ancient when the dinosaurs roamed the land above. Their flat forms folded through the world as they followed old ways through the close, cold confines of the world below. It was time to gather. Their leader had news. The Shadow Mage waited in the largest of the caves they called home. He was taller than the rest, but like them, he existed only in two dimensions. He could be the darkness cast across the wall behind an unknowing innocent, or a strange presence in his own right, so thin that he became invisible when viewed from the side. His ancestors had cast him at dusk, a time that had stretched him out to tower above his minions. It had filled him with the magic of that shifting point when day faded into night and tough predators became vulnerable prey. He was the greatest of his people, their leader, and the source of all their power. Still, the world he walked through when he emerged from the caves didn't suit him. It was a world made for solid people, for people of the light.
The Shadow Mage set down a crystal ball in the middle of the cavern. It glowed with a pale and sickly light, one that did little to chase away the smaller dark patches around the Shadow Men. That was how they liked it.
"That is the object you gained from Zero,"
the Shadow Sentry said. It was his duty to be watchful, observe the shapes and patterns of the world, and look for anything that might threaten the Shadow Men. The object was unusual, magical, and forged from light. That made it the sort of thing the Shadow Sentry was cautious about.
"It is."
The Shadow Mage brushed dust from the sphere's surface while more Shadow Men filed into the cave.
"It cost us dearly,"
the Shadow Steward added. He guarded the fortunes of their kin, calculated their power and counted their losses, keeping it all in his dark ledger.
"Brothers captured in the fight against those youths and the Silver Griffin fighting with them. The books were balanced, but the price was higher than it should have been. It was a price worth paying,"
the Shadow Mage said.
"I could have found it."
The Shadow Stalker was the hunter, the seeker, the one of them who most often went out into the world. He pursued targets that might be a person, an object, or simply an idea, to be retrieved or destroyed as the will of the darkness dictated. He scowled, an expression that no one but another Shadow Man could have seen.
"I should have been the one to find it. But you didn't,"
the Shadow Mage said.
"So we made a deal, because this matters more than your pride, or our ledger balance, or a few shadows lost to the light."
The others hissed.
"How can you say that of our brethren?"
the Shadow Sentry asked.
"Who have you been listening to? What light-sider ideas have infected your mind?" "I don't need the light-siders to recognize the value of this orb, even if your eyes cannot see it, or the steward cannot count its value, or the stalker cannot hunt it down. I have been studying it for months, and what I long suspected has proved true. This is the Stone of Dusk."
Whispers ran through the cave. They would have been excited whispers if the Shadow Men were capable of such a bright feeling. Instead, they were the dry whispers of fall leaves rattled by the wind, dead sounds from desiccated tongues.
"Are you certain?"
The Shadow Sentry ran a hand over the orb.
"He's right."
The Shadow Steward stared at the orb, and greed tinged his voice.
"Now that I've seen it, I can't unsee it. The stone. It is time."
The Shadow Mage nodded, then stretched his arms out to push the others gently but firmly away from the stone.
"The time has come."
He raised his voice so all the Shadow Men could hear.
"In the beginning, our ancestors held the Stone of Dawn. It showed them how the world began. A ball of light emerging from a great shadow and bringing us with it. That world's destiny was to become another true world, like the shadows from which it first emerged. But light captured it and held it hostage by powers that seek the brightness of illumination instead of the comfort that darkness brings. The Stone of Dawn showed the doom that has fallen upon us, but it also held out a promise. It told our ancestors that one day darkness would come. Magical forces would align, and we would have a chance to save this world from the light, to plunge it back into shadow so our people can spread across the earth. The Stone of Dusk's arrival would presage that time.
He held the orb aloft, and every face in the cavern felt the touch of its cold, faint light, the sort that didn't illuminate a path, but highlighted the darkness around it. They sighed in a shadow of happiness.
Now, it is our turn to carry out the rituals of foretelling,
the shadow mage said.
It is time to unlock the vision of the Stone of Dusk and see the future promised to us. To see how many more generations must pass before this world is ours.
The shadow men spread out around him, forming two rings. The inner ring, made up of the most powerful shadow men, circled clockwise around the shadow mage, while the outer ring circled counterclockwise. They moved with the strange unfolding and refolding steps of their kind, and they chanted as they danced. Each shadow man had a chant, passed down by his ancestors. No two were the same, but each became a thread in the spell that the shadow mage was weaving, and each played a crucial part. The voices flowed together, and order emerged from the chaos of sound. The shadow mage raised his hands. He was the silence to their sound, the shadow to their light, the death to their life. Magic flowed from his hands and filled the cave. The chanting and the movement of bodies stirred it, shifted it, reshaped it into new patterns, ones that none of them could have created or even foreseen alone. Threads of shadow twisted and turned, tangled and knotted, turned from simple darkness into something infinitely more complicated. A map to the future. The shadow men stopped moving. They kept chanting, their words carrying their power to feed the magic as it grew through the cave. All around them was something wonderful. Somewhere inside it was their hope for the future, one stripped clean of the solid, light-living creatures that dominated the world. A future made for them. Still, most of them didn't have the sophistication to understand what they were looking at, to unpick those strands and read what lay ahead. Only the shadow mage could do that. He lowered his hands and looked around. The prophecy surrounded him, a vast web of potential futures. The trick was to find the right one, the path they needed to follow for victory, the way that would set future generations on their course. When he found it, he couldn't believe it. The path was so much shorter than expected, complicated still, full of small details they would need to get right, and it would involve a great deal of effort from the shadow men. Still, there was no denying it. The day they lived for was coming, and far sooner than he'd thought. Barely able to contain his excitement, he plucked at the threads, drawing them to him to take a closer look. He examined every tiny detail, committing them to memory. This was the only way to do it. When the spell ended in a few minutes, this vision would fade, and there would be no going back to it. He'd prepared for this moment his whole life, mastering techniques of memory and understanding, engraving channels of magic through his mind. He read the patterns, and they became his. Then he stepped back and raised his hands. The rings of shadow men moved again, rotating in the opposite direction from the way they'd gone before.
threads of dark power unraveled, returning to the shadows they'd spooled from. The Shadow Mage stood triumphant in the middle of them. The chanting faded. The dance ended. The light dwindled in the Stone of Dusk, then vanished entirely. The orb cracked and fell to the floor in two jagged, uneven halves. Most of the Shadow Men stared at it in shock, but not the Shadow Steward, who'd seen its imperfection from the start. He'd known, as the Shadow Mage did, that this could work only once. Once was enough.
"It is done," the Shadow Mage announced. "I have seen the future, and our time is coming."
The Shadow Men nodded solemnly.
"Ours," the Shadow Mage emphasized. "Yours and mine. Not merely a time for our distant descendants. The time for victory is almost upon us."
Crackling whispers ran around the room.
"Soon the human world will end. By our hands the shadow time will arrive. The world will be cleansed of the bright, burning light and returned to the state of darkness from which it was born, the state of nature. We will stride a world made for us, by us."
The whispers rose to excited chatter, and the Shadow Mage did nothing to stop them. His people deserved this moment.
"Hard work lies ahead of us," he shouted over them. "Hard work and sacrifices. In the end, we will triumph because we are the shadows, and the light can never stop us."
The Shadow Men cheered. One of them started singing. More joined in, and others began dancing. Their celebrations filled the cave. The shadow time was coming. Chapter 3. Lucy took the roast out of the oven and carefully carried it through to the dining room. Bowls of potatoes, peas, and beans were already sitting on the table, along with Yorkshire puddings and gravy. It wasn't the best roast she'd ever made, thanks to the distraction of the previous night's dream, which kept gnawing at her mind, filling her with a vague, unnamed dread. However, a roast was still a roast, and she could think of nothing more comforting to eat in a time of stress. Plus, she knew the kids would gobble it up without a fuss. "Dinner's ready," she called. Feet thundered as her children stampeded through from the living room. First came Dylan, 12 years old and starting to shoot up. He'd always been tall for his age, but now he was really growing, and Lucy didn't think it would be long before he was taller than she was. That was a crazy thing to consider when it felt like only yesterday that he'd been a tiny pink creature waking up every 3 hours to howl for food. Next came Eddie, the opposite end of the household age spectrum, and the explanation for why they were so loud. The 3-year-old was currently in the shape of an elephant, although at least an infant one, having learned to control his size better since a recent giant animal incident in the backyard. His elephant feet pounded the floor and made the table shake, knives and forks rattling as they bounced up and down. Last came Ashley, less desperate for dinner than the boys. She didn't look up from the tangle of silvery threads in her hands, the string robot she'd been working on perfecting all summer. Now fall was coming, and while the days were shortening, her attention span wasn't. At 8 years old, the household science genius remained undistracted by dolls, clothes, boys, or any of the other things that would come within the next few years. Lucy almost wished she could keep her this age, her nose constantly in a science project. But then she wouldn't get to meet the extraordinary young woman her daughter would one day become. Ashley managed to take her seat without looking up from her robots, which she was contorting into structures that Lucy couldn't even pretend to understand. In the seat next to her, Dylan was already reaching for the potatoes.
Charlie, Lucy shouted. It's time for dinner, sweetheart.
Sample complete. Ready to continue?